Welcome back. I'm Ann Ricksecker. I'm the Associate Director of the Health Federation here in Philadelphia. We were formed 30 years ago as a consortium of FQHCs, and we continue to serve the communities that our programs in the FQHCs provide. We are home to the local performance site of the Pennsylvania Mid-Atlantic Age Education and Training Center, of which I'm the site director, and that's why I'm doing this introduction. Before I get started on that introduction, let me just add that this question that just came up right before the break, many people are in the room here from the regional office and from HRSA, and there is a SAMHSA-HRSA Center for Health Solutions, which is striving to address the question that was asked about the integration of behavioral health and primary care. And I will add that here in Philadelphia, we're lucky to have several such initiatives, including the SAMHSA HIV Behavioral Health Integration Program. It's my pleasure now to introduce the next presenter. I have four things to say about Dr. Linda Frank. They're not short either, but I will be quick. First, her academic leadership. Dr. Frank is at the University of Pittsburgh, an associate professor of three different schools there. First, she's associate professor of the School of Medicine, Clinical and Translational Science Institute. Second, she's associate professor of the School of Nursing, Community and Health Systems. And third, and near and dear to my heart, she's associate professor at the Graduate School of Public Health, where she, by the way, is the director of the MPH program. Second, in terms of nursing, there is so much one could say about Dr. Frank. Her leadership in nursing began even before we started the AIDS Education Training Center in 1988, by the way, when she was a psychiatric nurse liaison at the University of Pittsburgh. Since then, her leadership in nursing, particularly in HIV, has grown to an impressive scale. She's a fellow in the American Academy of Nursing, and she provides leadership for curricula and accreditation programs for HIV and nursing throughout the country. In addition, she was honored not once, but twice by the Association of Nurses in AIDS Care, first in 2004 for the HIV Nurses Education Award, and then again in 2008, an Advancement Award in HIV Leadership. Those are really strong recommendations from the field of nursing and HIV for recognition of leadership with Dr. Frank. The third thing I want to say, her consultation and leadership for HRSA, both nationally and internationally, has spanned at least two decades. She provides consultation for HRSA in this region and in this country, as well as internationally. She's a leader in what what was mentioned earlier by Dr. Harrison in the Federal Training Center Collaborative, which is our regional integration of HIV, family planning, STD, hepatitis, and behavioral health. And fourth, and nearest, of course, to my heart, Dr. Frank is the principal investigator and executive director of the regional Pennsylvania Mid-Atlantic AIDS Education and Training Center. Her region for that HRSA training award not only includes the region we're all sitting in today of Region 3, but HRSA also asked us to take on Ohio as well. So our region is the Mid-Atlantic region plus Ohio. In that leadership since 1988 at the University of Pittsburgh, Dr. Frank has led the effort to provide high-quality training, capacity building, and technical assistance to all healthcare professionals so that quality HIV care can be provided. So it's my honor to welcome my colleague and friend, Linda Frank.
Thanks, Ann. And I really could not do anything that I have done with the AATC without Ann Ricksecker and our colleagues at Philadelphia and throughout our region. And thank you for the invitation to be here today. And I hope I can provide some insight into what I think is a very important issue, and that is the issue of HIV and behavioral health. Greetings from Pittsburgh, the other city in Pennsylvania. and also from the Graduate School of Public Health at the University of Pittsburgh. And I like to say that I've worked my entire career on this square city block in Pittsburgh. At the Graduate School of Public Health, and the building behind that, that yellow building, is Western Psychiatric Institute and Clinic, where I worked for 15 years working in adult psychiatry with psychotic patients on inpatient units, child and adolescent services, and I worked in our freestanding psychiatric emergency room. So, and the reason I got involved in HIV, in addition to running the AATC, was because I was working with people with behavioral health problems, and I saw that so many of them were getting HIV infected. And that's really my passion for being in the field of HIV. Greetings from the AIDS Education and Training Centers across the country, a national program that really has made a difference in the quality of care for people with HIV. I want to mention, and I'm going to take my full 30 minutes if I could, the importance of advocacy in the HIV epidemic. And I recently gave a history of the HIV epidemic and another program, but there has been years of advocacy for HIV. In the beginning, we were in discoveries and delays, what I call, we really didn't know what was going on. And the opening speaker, Dr. Bach, is that his name? Yes. Talked about the early days of the epidemic when we really didn't know what we were doing. And then there was the protests and organizations, ACT UP, all these kinds of things, the protest at the NIH and the FDA. And then in the early 90s, cautiously optimistic because we had these medicines that could treat people with HIV. But the Berlin meeting, the international meeting in Berlin, when we learned that taking only one drug really didn't make any difference in how long people lived. That was an important, and that was a very depressing meeting, actually. And then we found that treatment makes a difference. After Vancouver, we found out that as a result of Dr. Rinaldo and Dr. Mellers from the University of Pittsburgh, who did a look-back study and found that people who had a higher viral load died sooner. Now we think, well, duh, that makes sense. But we didn't know that then. And then we had triple combination therapy that we could give people, and that really made a difference. So it made a difference for people to get HIV tested and to get into care. And then we had this PEPFAR in the worldwide. It became a worldwide focus for funding. We can no longer just look at the United States. It's a global issue. And then now we're hearing treatment as prevention. And I'm not going to talk about that today, but that's a really hot topic that was talked about at the most recent International AIDS Conference. But this is the system of care that we have, and this is a schematic that I developed a number of years ago for a grant. But people with HIV need a team. No one discipline can take care of people with HIV. Now, I want to know why nurses in Africa have an expanded practice that nurse practitioners and PAs don't even have in the United States. There's something wrong. And with the Affordable Care Act, we are going to need more advanced practice clinicians, not just physicians, to take care of people with HIV and behavioral health. We need social workers. We need case managers. We need everybody. Because it's very, very complicated. And so we need support services, housing. We need community intervention. We need the primary prevention, secondary prevention, all of that. And we need the expert consultation that our HIV clinical experts can provide for people with HIV. And we can get this in big cities. We can get it in Philadelphia. We can get it in Pittsburgh. But we just got a new project funded, the telehealth project for rural Appalachia. Let me tell you, people in Appalachia are not getting this. And people in rural areas are not getting this. And I would venture to say that there are people in our inner cities that are not getting this. Because they're not linked into care for a variety of reasons. The big thing now is the patient-centered medical home model. It has implications for psychiatric services and implications for people with mental health and substance abuse, and for people with HIV. But a lot of the people with behavioral health problems, substance abuse, and chronic mental illness, they don't have a home to live in to begin with, let alone a medical home. So this is a huge problem. I see some heads shaking around the room. And so the population in the early days of the epidemic was very different than what we're seeing now, okay? In the beginning, it was gay white men. But now we have people with, and you've heard this, substance abuse, personality disorders, chronic mental illness, poverty, minorities are overrepresented, and language and cultural barriers. It's not just Americans. We have our big cities where we have people from other countries living in our cities, and the culture is so diverse. And we have to have not only a workforce that is able to address the behavioral health needs, but the cultural barriers and the cultural needs in integrating that into our health services can't be understated. I want to mention stigma. There's a lot of psychosocial issues for people with HIV, but stigma still remains a number one thing. For people with HIV and for people with psychiatric illness and substance abuse. So if you're a person that has HIV, you abuse substances, and you also are depressed, you've got three areas of stigmatization. And I would venture to say that people who are working in these fields are also stigmatized. Substance abuse people, treatment people, people who work in psychiatry. I've had people say to me when I was working in psychiatry, "Hey, why don't you come over and be a real clinician? What are you doing in psychiatry?" There's an assumption that if you're working in substance abuse or mental health, then anybody can do it. I used to have people come up to me and say, "Well, what do you do working in psychiatry? You sit around and play cards with the patients?" I mean, I really do think that that assumption is still out there. So the World Health Organization definition of health. Health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. Notice the mental health. It gets short shrift because it's not prestigious to work in these fields. It's not the same, and I come from the University of Pittsburgh, I can say this. It's not as prestigious as doing liver transplants, okay? Because we're a big transplant center, everybody knows that. And so what we have now for people with HIV is a complex system of antiretroviral treatment. The HIV care system is complex, but because of Ryan White, we have been able to integrate services under Ryan White. There's a good part of that and there's a bad part of that. The good part about it is people don't have to go somewhere else to get their psychiatric services because we've added psychiatric services to Ryan White primary care clinics, okay? But I also feel that it's left the mental health system and the substance abuse system off the hook because they say, well, you have HIV and you have a mental health problem, go over there and let the Ryan White people take care of you. And I'm making general sweeping statements, and maybe that's not true in some programs that you know about, but in the ones that I know about around the state and around our region, there's a lot of places where that is true. The mental health system is complex, and patients are very complex now. HIV is only one of the many problems, and this has already been mentioned. So I want to say that mental health is public health. And you can't have true public health without having a mental health system that is responsive to people who have a variety of needs. And I want to mention here the intersecting issues around people with substance abuse and mental illness and HIV. You have somebody with HIV, but there are very many intersecting issues. Domestic violence, homelessness, and incarceration. This is a huge problem. We're about the business of building prisons in the United States and opening more prisons. We've closed down the state mental hospitals for the most part. There are very few of them. And deep in the last century, when I was a diploma nurse, way back when, and I did my rotation at Warren State Hospital up in Warren, Pennsylvania. You all probably don't know where that is. It's out in the middle of the woods. It was a very different thing. Not to say that we need to go back to institutionalizing people, but when we decided to close down the state mental hospitals, the money was supposed to go to community programs for people with mental illness. The money never followed the patient. We do have some community programs, and Ann Ricksacker was talking about this model program that's happening here in Philadelphia, which I applaud. We need more programs like that, more community programs, because the institutional, I'm not saying the institutions are the answer. They're not the answer, but we need to put our heads together about innovative ways of addressing these things. Somebody else already talked about the years of loss to disability. 5 out of 10 of the most disabling illnesses in the world are mental illness. Depression tops the list. Other disorders, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and drug use disorders. And this is the case in low, middle, and high-income countries across the world. And somebody else already talked about this. Mental illness precedes HIV in most at-risk populations. In IDUs, there are high rates of alcohol and substance abuse. In MSMs, there is elevated alcohol and substance use disorders, depression, anxiety disorders. Sex workers, elevated rates of addictive disorders, suicidal ideation, and post-traumatic stress disorder. And primary HIV prevention involves reaching special populations with high rates of mental illness. And those special populations to reach people with these types of mental illnesses are the same populations that we have difficulty reaching in addressing the HIV epidemic. And that's already been mentioned. But it bears additional mentioning. Following severe depression, alcohol use disorder is the next most disabling mental illness. And HIV positive people with heavy drinking predicts poor adherence, HIV progression, liver damage, and end stage liver disease, and overall mortality. In terms of primary prevention, we've already talked about this a little bit, so I think I'm going to skip this. It's in your handout. But the correlation between HIV and mental health, and I want to acknowledge here my colleagues at Columbia University, Francine Cornos, who is the director of the New York, New Jersey AETC, who did a satellite session at the recent AIDS International Conference, and they talked about this issue. Keep in mind, it was a satellite meeting, okay? It was not a central meeting to the conference. So I think it gives you some indication of where all of this is on the priority list. But in terms of the impact of mental health on HIV, there's impaired judgment and high-risk behavior, and I have here the resources for that. Psychiatric disorders such as depression have been consistently linked to lower likelihood of receiving antiretroviral treatment, poor medication adherence, greater mortality, non-adherence, influences disease progression, and successful treatment of depression improves adherence. Mental health conditions are underdiagnosed. Persons living with AIDS are twice as likely to suffer from depression. And in all cohorts, ART was associated with reduced anxiety, depression, and dementia. So there is a real reason to really get on board with doing much more integration here. Depression is the most common mental disorder, on average presenting 30 to 50% of HIV-positive people have depression. And, you know, sometimes people say, well, you know what, if I had HIV, I'd be depressed too. But then people don't get the right treatment. They don't get medicine. Well, they're depressed. Depression rates vary by study design, but people living with HIV and chronic depressive symptoms have 2 times greater risk of dying than people living with HIV who are not depressed. In the HERS cohort, which was 765 HIV-positive women at four sites in the United States, followed up for 7 years. Mortality predictors were chronic depression, CD4 cell count, antiretroviral treatment duration, and age. After adjusting for all the variables, women with chronic depressive symptoms were twice as likely to die as women with limited or no depressive symptoms. And these results have been repeated in other U.S. studies. Untreated depression is associated with failure to access treatment, failure to adhere to drugs, and these facts call for early detection and treatment of depression. And the use of antidepressants in mental health therapy or mental health therapy alone are associated with increased antiretroviral utilization, and compliance with antidepressants use was associated with improved HIV adherence, and laboratory parameters such as higher CD4 cell count and lower viral load. Now, this is the World Health Organization service organizational pyramid for optimal mix of services for mental health. And one of the things that I want to point out here is that people need community health, psychiatric services in general hospitals, long-term care facilities. It's not much used here in the U.S. much anymore because of the deinstitutionalization movement. But primary care, mental health services, informal community care, and self-care. And in other places around the world, they're putting a lot more focus on informal community care and self-care. And in the HIV arena, we did this early on in the epidemic with what we called the Buddy Program, okay? And now we're doing things like healthcare navigators. That seems to be the big phrase that people are using now. But we also need other people, community lay people, to help people with HIV and behavioral health problems, to help them understand, to help them to transverse the complicated systems of care that we have, and also to provide support, and integrating that into our system. In Zimbabwe, they've developed such a program, and this was presented at the most recent International AIDS Conference, and I think people really need to begin to think about what other models have been used in resource-poor settings to reach people with HIV and behavioral health problems. And Sebelius at the International AIDS Conference mentioned in her speech that she was going to convene a group of people from around the world in the international PEPFAR community to look at models that had been developed around the world internationally under PEPFAR that could be used in this country. So we often think about our ideas shaping what's happening around the world. We are beginning to think about resource-poor settings helping us to shape things here in the United States around behavioral health and HIV and other issues around HIV in our resource-poor settings here in the United States and in places where we need to put increased effort. The USAID put out in 2009 a special publication on mental health and the HIV timeline. And at the International AIDS Conference, I'll take two more minutes and then I'm going to stop. This is the Presidential Advisory Committee on HIV/AIDS. It would occurred at the same time that the International AIDS Conference was happening. And, of course, being the advocate that I am and having done some work on Capitol Hill, I decided to make myself known at this particular meeting, because here is my issue around untreated mental illness and people with HIV or untreated mental illness in general, is that they're ending up in our prisons and jails. And not only are we building more prisons, we're building more mental health units in the prisons across the country. And so here's my testimony that I gave at the Presidential Advisory Committee on AIDS. I would respectfully request the President's Advisory Committee increase efforts on two intersecting issues, that of the mentally ill who are at risk for HIV and those who are incarcerated. The lack of an adequately funded and coordinated mental health and HIV care system results in the criminalization of those in need of mental health and HIV treatment. Of course, I had to say, I would like to note that the AIDS Education and Training Center has been providing education to mental health professionals and prison health professionals and are prepared to continue this effort. And we have. In fact, in Pennsylvania, our AATC, or Philadelphia office and Pittsburgh office, has done training in all 25 state correctional facilities in Pennsylvania. We've trained the clinicians, the custody staff, probation and parole, and we did it for many years. For about 10 years, we had a project doing that. But what my final two slides, I want to point out that mental illness can be successfully screened and treated. And there are developed guidelines, and the treatments for mental illness compare favorably to treatments for other chronic diseases. You know, people talk about, well, you know, people with substance abuse, they come in for treatment, and then they, you know, fall off the wagon and they start abusing again. This happens with people who have diabetes. This happens with people who have high blood pressure. They quit taking their medicine. What's the difference? There's not a difference. Successful treatment for mental illness includes medication and psychotherapy. And you need specific training to be a psychotherapist. Not everybody can do this. Not everybody should be prescribing psychotropic medications. And similar outcomes are associated with people with psychotic disorders. Getting them into care, getting them into treatment. Think about the Colorado situation, the Black Knight, the shooter for the Black Knight. When I listened to what was on television, I was appalled. All I heard about was gun control. I'm not going to get into gun control. I don't have a gun. I don't want a gun. But there was very little discussion about the mental health system. This person has schizophrenia. What do you think is going to happen to him? Huh? He may end up on death row. I'm against having mentally ill people on death row. They should not be in death row. And we have people with chronic mental illness who are diagnosed schizophrenics on death row in Pennsylvania. That should not be the case. The mental health system have failed a lot of people. So, finally, mental health treatment and substance abuse treatment are harm reduction for HIV. People think about harm reduction as only needle exchange. And oh, by the way, I was on the underground needle exchange program early in Pittsburgh when it was illegal. And you have a similar program here in Philly as well. Congratulations. And they have stopped the ban on using federal funding for needle exchange programs because it really does work. But I want to say getting people on treatment for mental illness, getting people on treatment for substance abuse is, in fact, harm reduction. And we have to expand our thinking about what harm reduction is. In terms of the advocacy agenda, we can't ignore mental illness and expect to provide effective HIV prevention and treatment. And each one of us is needed to change the current neglect of mental illness. The integration of medical and clinical services and behavioral health has become a priority. There's funding available for this. Philadelphia's got some of that funding. The Ryan White program provides it. And at the state and the local level, however, there still remains impediments to service integration by various laws and statutes and local complications. Let me just put it that way. And finally, the policy agenda, we must begin and continue to the conversation on integration. Changing the laws, statutes, and policies. The parallel mental health and HIV systems must engage in thinking and planning for integration and efficient use of resources. And goals targeting improved public health that includes mental health must compete for policy attention and resources. We have to scale up, just like in resource-poor settings, to address the issue of integration of behavioral health and HIV services. Affordable and effective interventions have been shown to improve health outcomes for people living with HIV and can be delivered by providers in HIV and primary care settings. And despite these compelling facts, Very little international and country-level HIV funding is devoted to screening for and treating mental illness, and we've got to change it. Thank you very much.